Well, today on Power Witness, we have two fellows and a friend of the St. Gabriel Institute. And we have Julian Haida Natalia, and she'll pronounce her own name, and Brother Daniel Kolasa, who's a seminarian in Ukraine. But Julian, let's begin with you kind of to talk about the saint, to introduce the topic of the St. Gabriel Institute and Christian Witness.
Sure. Well, I'm but a friend of the Institute, so I'll let the actual fellows who've gone through this intense half-year residential program in Washington, D.C., in Christian diplomacy and communications speak about their experiences. I'm very privileged to, as a former seminarian myself, and as an advocate for a just peace in Ukraine, to work with the St. Gabriel Institute as they bring the stories, especially of Christian witness, here to the United States during their time in Washington, D.C., and traveling to places like Irondale, Alabama, to share the story of both the Ukrainian martyrs past and martyrs present who are suffering under what is truly an incredible moment in world history. Before you started rolling the microphone, we talked about how it really hasn't been since World War II that there's been such a land war, this kind of land war fought over territory as Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And so while the Institute fellows work on Catholic social teaching writ large, the main issue affecting our church today is the Russian occupation of 20% of Ukraine, the Russian attempt to seize all of Ukraine, and the effect that that has particularly on Ukrainian families, Ukrainian children who are being used by the Russians as a pawn in the war, who are being abducted. At least 19,546 Ukrainian children have been taken away from their families and have been used as bargaining chips. And so we find that to be an affront against their dignity. Also the fact that the future that Russia envisions for Ukraine does not allow for Catholics like us to worship freely in Ukraine. And so when the people of Ukraine are fighting against the Russian occupation, they are also fighting for the very kinds of rights and privileges that we have in the United States for the free expression of our faith, the existence of our church, after a very long history of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, and now the Russian Federation under President Vladimir Putin, to not allow us to live out our faith, not allow children to live with their families. And so that is really what the fight is about. It's not, for Ukrainians, it's not just about defending their land. That's obviously a very important part of it. But it's about defending the very innate kind of human dignity that we read about in the gospel and we know intimately as Christians.
Right. And so like the western part of Ukraine, what percentage would be Ukrainian Catholic, Ukrainian Rite Catholic?
So the Ukrainian Catholic Church is a worldwide phenomenon. We're Byzantine Rite, and so we don't celebrate kind of the Mass in the kind of Latin Novus Ordo way, or even the traditional Latin Mass. We use the Byzantine Rite, which is shared with the Greek Orthodox Church. The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church represents about 10% of the population of Ukraine. So that's give or take 4 or 5 million people. And then there's maybe around another million who live in places like the American Midwest, or Australia, or Brazil, or Argentina. So we're really a global community. And our church is now, has in about 20 years ago, made its triumphant return back to Kyiv, where our church was founded over 1,000 years ago, because during the Russian imperial era, our church was forced out of Kyiv. And so now our church exists all over Ukraine, but because it was forced west during the imperial era, our kind of heartland is Western Ukraine, which many people refer to as the Bible Belt of Europe. It has among the highest rates of church going in all of Europe. These are deeply God-fearing people. And so when the war is being fought, it's not, again, it's not just about people being Ukrainian, but it's also about their ability to worship freely and as Catholics and as Greek Catholics, as Byzantine Rite Catholics. President Putin, in his justification for the war, He wrote this, I don't want to call it historical, but an alternate history of President Putin's, where he blamed us Byzantine Rite Catholics in part for the war. He blamed us for dividing the Orthodox world. Of course, that is the exact opposite of our intent. For the last 500 years, we've been an example of how the Orthodox and the Catholic world can live indeed in communion and in harmony with one another. And that is the witness we continue to bear. And that is what apparently poses a threat to Russia. But we're not intending, as Eastern Rite Catholics, on going anywhere, even if that means having to defend against an unjust war that has left millions displaced and thousands injured or dead.
So the population that is there in Western Ukraine, they're almost all Ukrainian or Byzantine, right?
I think the majority of the population of Western Ukraine is Byzantine Rite Catholic, Ukrainian Greek Catholic. But there are, you know, Ukraine has long been a religiously diverse place. And so there's a Roman Catholic kind of Latin Rite minority. There are certain Protestant groups. There are Jewish groups. Of course, the Nazi Germany did its darndest to get rid of Judaism in Western Ukraine, which was also a Jewish heartland. And all of these groups have really thrived under an independent Ukraine since the fall of the Soviet Union. And Russia is posing an existential threat against this really beautiful rebirth of not only Christian witness, but just of religious witness and of interreligious dialogue and prayer and understanding.
Just to speak to that, an example of my uncle served.
So your brother, sorry, can you say your name?
Danilo. Brother Danilo Kolasa, yeah.
Danilo Kolasa, okay.
Yeah. So I myself am from Western Ukraine, and my uncle served in a little town called Shcherets, just outside of Lviv. And there were three different churches there. There was the Ukrainian Catholic one, there was the, still is the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, and a Roman Catholic Church. And people went to different ones. People were of different rites or denominations, but often they would celebrate different feasts together. Like they would go, you know, they would come together to the Roman Catholic Church, especially when at a time when Christmas was on different calendars. A lot of people would go to celebrate with the Roman Catholics on the 25th. Or there's actually a fun phenomenon, which is not very typical for the Eastern Rite at all, is to have instruments. But this particular town had a long-standing tradition of a few instruments playing for specifically the Christmas vigil, liturgy or mass. And I was very shocked by this when I was there. Mm-hmm. But my uncle told me, you know, when I found out that the same band will play here at the Ukrainian Catholic Church at midnight, and then we'll go over to the Orthodox Church at 6 a.m. and also play during the Divine Liturgy, I was like, okay, you know, it's like this is a long-standing town tradition. Mm-hmm. And they would also play at the Latin Rite Mass. And so there was this communion of people that perhaps had their differences to some extent, but they still shared this union. Just to go back to.
Indeed, they're doing the work of reversing the schism, both small schisms and great schism alike. And they're truly doing that work every single day. And that poses a threat, I think, to Vladimir Putin, who wants to have one church that is state controlled. And having villages figure things out among each other, have them pray among each other, even through disagreements, that's not the kind of society or future that he envisions for either for Russia or for Ukraine or, frankly, even for the rest of Europe.
And I think that's hard. I've been told by Eastern Europeans, I've got a friend that talks about this, but they say it's so hard for Westerners to get that mind of, like, Mother Russia and like this identity with the Russian Orthodox Church, that that it's part of this, I guess they see it as like this God-anointed mission, right? That to spread their faith there and twisted way and an invasion and stuff, but is that true? Like, I don't, can you explain the concept of Mother Russia? How do the Russians see themselves and their role?
Sure, that's a great question. It's actually now something that by the Ecumenical Patriarch and other bishops of the Orthodox Church has been condemned as a heresy. Mm. It's a form of what is called ethnophilitism, which is a sense that somehow one national church was selected among others to somehow save the world. And we call this heresy currently, it's taken on the name of the Russian world, the Ruski Mir. And it's something that's been around for much longer than this war or even the current modern. It has its roots back in the 18th century. It's this idea that Russia has been chosen by God to be the last bastion of Christianity and to save the world by any means necessary.
They call Moscow, for example, the third Rome. So they say the first Rome fell during the schism. Mm. The second Rome, Constantinople, fell under the Ottomans. And so they believe that the third Rome is Moscow and is their responsibility to save Christianity after the first two Romes fell. So it's very deeply ingrained in not only their religious ideology, but also their state ideology. And a big proponent of this Russian world is President Putin himself.
And the patriarch of the Moscow. So what's interesting about this particular ideology is that it wasn't the state that decided, okay, we need a religious ideology to justify our war. There was already a religious ideology in place that they simply had to take and use. And it is something that is called a holy war against the evil West. Mm. And so the only way we can do that is by military means, is by invading this country. And it is very scary in many ways when you see photos or you hear the statements of priests saying that, you know, in a way very close to what you hear in radical Islamist movements. Right. If you go in this war and if you die there, you are already saved.
Right. Patriarch Kirill has said that of Russian soldiers. It's been a direct quote from the Patriarch of Moscow that if any Russian soldier who gives their life in battle against Ukraine will have eternal life, which is a pretty scary notion to promise a young soldier. Hmm. But you had something to comment.
Natalia.
If you could say your full name for us, Natalia.
Yeah, my full name is Natalia Skoraiko. I want to add a few words. Almost a year ago, two priests of our Ukrainian Catholic Church were released from Russian prisons. And they testified the torture they endured, severe beatings, starving as a method of abuse. But what struck me the most in this testimony is that during the interrogation with the Russian soldiers, our priest, Bohdan Heleta, he realized that they see the Ukrainian Catholic Church as a sect. That is their perception. And their actions are heavily influenced through this perception. And I also heard one testimony of a Protestant pastor. He was also in Russian prisons. And they beat them. Him so hard that with the justification that he is obsessed with evil spirits and the only way to repentance is through Russian Orthodoxy. That's the way they see it. That's the madness that we deal with.
Right. Maybe, Natalia, let me ask you a follow-up question on that. How would you describe with your feminine, womanly intuition your perspective, your feeling of the people, the lay people of the Ukraine? What is their spirit? How do they see this war? How are they dealing with it? How would you describe that?
Definitely Ukrainians want peace, but they want just peace. We're suffering a lot. From century to century, whether it be Russian Empire or Soviet Union or Putin's Russia, it's always a question of our existence as a nation and our identity. we have a God-given dignity, as Julian said, and we have a right to self-determination. We have a right to our faith. Mm-hmm. That's all we want. We don't want anything that don't belong to us.
Right.
And we have a right to defend ourselves. That's our intention. That's an idea. It's our homeland. Yeah. It's a land of our parents, grandparents. And it's brutally abused. And a few days ago, I received the heartbreaking news that my close friend was killed in the combat. He was 31 years old, a young man who lived behind his family, his parents, his young wife, his two little sons. What is his motivation? Love. His motivation is love. That's the way our army defend us. Not because they hate Russia or Russian people. We pray for them, for their conversion. But because of love to their homeland and to their families to be protected.
Oh, brother, let me ask you about your seminary. We should say in the Byzantine Rite, you can get married.
That's right. Before.
Before ordination.
Yes, exactly. I'm engaged to be married.
And I know seminarians are really good at mixing with priests and bishops. And I know here in America, it's like you get a read on a lot of things being in the seminary and things. What is your read, like, from priests and bishops that you hear? Like, how are they approaching this conflict, of persevering through it, or where are they at?
That's a great question. And to me, I studied in Austria and then came back to Ukraine to serve for a little bit as part of my formation in campus ministry. And so to me, going to Ukraine right now and meeting these priests, seminarians, and others has been incredibly inspiring. But just any, you know, even the laity and the faithful, because the church is represented in many different ways. From the front lines to hospitals, from funerals to births and simply humanitarian aid, the church is very deeply connected and very involved in trying to be there with the people, no matter what the situation is. From occupied territories to refugees outside of Ukraine. The church is always trying to find its sheep and be there. And so I'd like to just give a few examples of that. During my time in Ukraine, I was able to visit cities close to the front lines to get something that seminarians and others will do. And in fact, the choir that I sang with at the Ukrainian Catholic University, as part of their Easter and Christmas mission, they would go to the front lines to bring, because in Ukraine especially, Easter and Christmas, those are traditions of just incredible joy and life-giving force, of celebrating Easter, singing songs. The liturgies are beautiful, incredible, and so joyful. And so they would go to those front lines to sing for either soldiers, but also just for the people that lived there, bringing this joy of Easter. And they experienced a lot coming back, because those people who are closest and are suffering the most have the most to share of just incredible gifts of faith, of witnessing to living there and remaining and holding on to faith. The two priests that Natalia mentioned that were in captivity and came back, they gave incredible witness of strength and love, of praying for their for those who harmed them, for those who persecuted them, of standing with the people and continually speaking. They were treated as anyone else in these prison camps. They were beat, they were tortured, they were put in. If you've read He Leadeth Me, it's not changed much. Mm-hmm. The same methods are being used to torture people, put them in solitary confinement, blast Soviet music, in order to make people go mad and such. But still, they would continue praying, and then they would, when they were in prison, they would do their best to try find ways to pray. And one of these priests gave this example while he was in prison with all these other, usually they were put in a prison camp of soldiers. So they were especially badly treated because they were together with soldiers as priests, purposely sent there. And they had this small window just before a meal or just after a meal where they were gathered together, where they would have a minute or two time to pray. And so he would gather these soldiers around himself and they would pray the Our Father. They would pray for their loved ones, for each other. And one of the most beautiful testimonies he gave was, while he was there, he said, "I felt the church praying for me." So our prayers, for especially for those who are in captivity, are incredibly powerful. And those situations make them feel them all the more. He said, "I felt the Pope praying for me. I felt the whole church praying for me." He said, "Now I can't feel it as much that I've returned, but when I was there, that was what kept me going, are those prayers."
That's a good thing to highlight. So all of us can pray. Maybe I'll listen to this podcast to pray for those suffering for the faith.
And it's worth highlighting that this is happening right now. Like, we hear some of these stories and it sounds like something out of a black and white movie or something from a war long past. Priests with soldiers, prisoners of war, in camps who are being forced through horrible torture. It is happening right now. And especially how invaluable our prayers are, and also any other way that we have to support them. But the prayers are felt and they do work.
Has there been some bishops that have been eloquent during this time, that any that stand out as being good witnesses?
So in Ukraine, almost all bishops are being very, very loud and and, I mean, first of all, supporting the people. The Council of Ukrainian Bishops, the Bishops Conference, the Synod, has started a whole program called Healing the Wounds of War, where we're creating spaces to train people to be able to work with PTSD, work with soldiers, work with simply with refugees, with people in all areas, in order to be able to counteract the incredible wounds that war brings with it. There's rehabilitation centers, especially because, you know, people who've gone through trauma start to deal with substance abuse as well, and so they're creating spaces where that can be healed. Our bishop in Donetsk, or from Donetsk, who is in Zaporizhia, which is 30 kilometers, about 20 miles from the front lines, still there, won't move anywhere. And he's there, and he's every day he's on in his car, he's driving from one city to another on the front lines, visiting people, talking to people, blessing soldiers, you know, being there and bringing priests to hear confessions, bringing seminarians and choirs to sing, to bring hope to those who are there on the very front lines. So Bishop Maxim Rebucha is definitely an incredible inspiration, who I had the incredible honor to spend some time with while I was visiting there. His witness and the witness of the many priests that work in his diocese.
And what would, you know, maybe his spirituality? I know the Byzantine, right, in general, but I also heard about the Ukrainians. They have a great devotion to Mary, of course.
And very much so, yes.
And to the angels, right?
Yes,
Is the one of the cathedrals named after the angels?
St. Michael's Orthodox Cathedral in Kyiv is definitely one of them.
Yeah. The Archangel Michael is the protector of Kyiv. And we mentioned about the early stages of the war and how destructive those first few months were back in 2022 and how people are living under occupation. The biggest city that the Russians captured since 2022 is a city called Mariupol. Now, for context, this is a city that's about the population of Cleveland, right? There was about 300,000 people living there. It's a very ancient Greek colony, and Mariupoli, the city of Mary. So there's deep, painful symbolism to the fact that this long-suffering city bears the name of our mother. Mm. And people who continue to be trapped in that city and buried in mass graves in that city, and that we really have no way of communicating with. Mm. And we know that there are Christians in that city. It was actually a very large Protestant hub, in addition to being a historic kind of Orthodox city as well. I met the pastor of the church there, and there's this harrowing video that you could visit RussiaTorturesChristians.com. You could see it right on their homepage of Russian troops pulling into the yard in front of the church, pulling out a chainsaw, cutting down the cross in front of the church, yeah. Walking into the church in the sanctuary during the service, walking onto the stage in their full military combat mm-hmm. uniforms, mm-hmm. and raising the Russian flag and telling everybody to go home. Mm. I mean, they went for the church first, mm-hmm. in of all places, mm-hmm. the city of Mary.
Wow.
Because the church to them represents the biggest threat.
Wow. I also want to add that my diocese, located in Chernivtsi, it's far away from the front line, and is a base for replaced people and refugees. And with the blessing of our bishop, Yosafat Moshich, and his support, we hold several retreats for soldiers and their families, because we think that mothers, wives, and kids of our soldiers needs the same support, psychological, emotional, and spiritual. So being far away from the battles, it's our task to embrace these people with love and kindness and acceptance, well, support.
Tell us about some more about like the Marian devotion. The rosary is not emphasized, right? You have other forms, or is it?
So Natalia is saying that their bishop is the Marian bishop in Ukraine. But just to the question of the rosary, there's a lot of Ukrainians pray the rosary. In fact, when the war started in 2014, mm-hmm. In our church, it's not necessarily part of our tradition, but in Ukraine, it's long been something that has kind of made its way into our tradition is the rosary. And in fact, in fact, they started in 2014 what is called the Rosary Unites Us. Mm. It's a nationwide initiative to pray the rosary every evening at 9 p.m. Kyiv time. And it's done by a different parish every day, led by a different priest at a different parish, and that happens every day. Right. And one incredible story is a priest that was also under occupation for 9 months, the Father Sashko Bohomaz, incredible priest. He was deported from the Russian occupied territories. He was one of those who was bagged and put into a car and then brought to what's called the gray zone, the one between the front lines, and told to walk. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, that moment when he was crossing, he said, was the most intimate moment with God. But before they took him, this was another interrogation that had happened. He said he was at home at the parish house. Masked men with guns, soldiers came in and just started turning things over in the house. And then they set a gun to his head and would question him. And then they continued. And he said, I was scared. I was really scared. And so the only thing I had was I took out my rosary and I started praying. And I started praying out loud as I could. I didn't care what they thought, what they would say to me. And I just prayed the rosary very loudly. Mm-hmm. And then they bagged him and then they brought him to the front lines. Mm-hmm. And he walked across. And the first person he met on the Ukrainian side was one of his previous parishioners who had enlisted in the army. Mm. And then he understood that he was safe. And since then, he's been incredibly active, especially in military chaplaincy. And the way he describes it is he tries to create a friendship with these soldiers, because he said through a friendship with a priest, he hopes, and they do often, they create a friendship with God, these soldiers. He said, the biggest gift I can receive is when a soldier tells me, I feel like I have developed a friendship with God. And so he has been an incredible inspiration to me myself. I've got to meet him a few times, and just his simple and humble way, but incredible, this bravery and force. And his main prayer is definitely the rosary. But just to give Natalia the moment to speak to
it's a small gift for you. It's a miraculous icon from our city, which is in our cathedral in Chernivtsi. And it's called Hope for Hopeless, and it's a year of hope. And in 2021, Pope Francis crowned it. Yes, and once a month we have a special prayer to Mary, to Our Lady, for our church, for our people, and for all Catholics and Christians.
As Natalia mentioned, I mean, not only is this miraculous icon of the Mother of God, but there are so, and in addition to the rosary, so there's such a rich devotion to the Mother of God, to Mary in Ukraine, that manifests in so many different ways, not only with these icons, but the feast of the protection of the Mother of God is actually a state holiday in Ukraine. It is Ukrainian Defenders Day. So there's a kind of a story of how, ironically, the medieval Ukrainians were attempting to sack Constantinople. And the Mother of God appeared above the Blansherni Church in Constantinople, pulled out her veil, and those invading forces weren't able to harm the Christians that were inside the church. And why do I say that's ironic? Because today the Greek Orthodox don't really recognize this holiday or really celebrate it. But in Ukraine, which, as the story goes, was the bad guy, it has become the most important holiday, the protector of all warriors and defenders. Another very important Marian note is in almost every, you know, in every Latin church, you have to have a crucifix behind the altar, right? In our churches, yes, we'll have a cross behind the altar, but the focal point of prayer is an icon of the Orans, of the Mother of God with her outstretched arms. And in the center of Kyiv, there stands a cathedral, the kind of the mother church of all Ukrainian Christians, Saint Sophia. And there's a mosaic from the 11th century of the Mother of God with her arms outstretched on this brick wall. And this cathedral has stood there for 1,000 years, longer than any church in Moscow has. And it's referred to locally as the immovable wall. Because even after 1,000 years of different empires, of the Turks and of the Mongols, and even the Poles and the Russians, everybody who's attempted to seize the city, that icon has been there for 1,000 years. And the belief is that so long as the immovable wall with Our Lady stands, the city will stand and the people will remain faithful. So there's a very, very deep devotion to the Mother of God in Ukraine, as specifically the protectress of our people.
And like traditional prayer to Our Lady, does it also involve some psalms, or is there a different prayer than the Hail Mary?
I mean, the Hail Mary is definitely one of the founding prayers, and we use that prayer very much. There's a bit of a different nuance in translation. We don't have the second part of it, but it's the same text from the scripture.
The second part, pray for us sinners now at the hour of our death.
Exactly. We have a special devotional prayer called the Akathist.
That's what I was thinking.
The Akathist is definitely something a lot of Ukrainians love to pray, but it's all over the world, the Byzantine world. It's a beautiful prayer. If no one's ever been to one, it's definitely worth going to. And it has, I mean, it's in a similar way, it's a little bit like the rosary, because it meditates upon, especially in what we would call the joyful mysteries. And in between, it has all these names given to Mary. If one were to look at it through a Latin Rite lens, it's like the rosary intertwined with the litany.
Exactly.
And it's almost always beautifully sung. I mean, the melody is something else. People can, I think, look at Vatican media and see how many Eastern Catholic bishops prayed at the Church of Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome, the Akathist, and all sang together. Rejoice, O Mother, rejoice, O Mother. Yeah. Rejoice. And it's a very kind of joyful hymn, and you can see the video. I mean, you have to check it out, how kind of full heart, with their full heart and full throat, these yeah. bishops and these faithful are singing it in the square in Rome, in front of, you know, the very icon that Pope Francis revered so much as well.
You know, something I've just thought about, you mentioned, Father or Brother, the PTSD from war, and that's something that hit me early on. And we talk a lot about PTSD in this country. And I think there's been a coming awareness of it and just trauma people can have from their life growing up. But in the case of Ukraine, you know, being bombed and just suffering so much, I think that'd be such something that's going to have to be overcome for generations, really, I think.
And it's not the first trauma. What in Ukraine, one of the sad and very serious issues that we have, the wounds that we carry through generations, starting, you know, way back, you know, in the 16th century and until now, because our country has been occupied for a very long time. And the war, the way it is now, is not something out of the blue. It's something that is a re-eruption of wars that have been going on in Ukraine for centuries. Mm-hmm. And the genocide that happened in the 1930s, the Holodomor, where millions of people were killed by hunger very forcefully. It was a planned, what do you call it, an artificial famine that was made mm-hmm. in a specific region of Ukraine to destroy the spirit of resistance that was there. And then later on,
Stalin.
Yeah. And then the First World War, the Second World War, the occupation under the Bolsheviks up until the 1980s, and at the end in 1991. Then, so all of these traumas that get passed on, it's simple things like the way you deal with food, and the way you have a hard time trusting people because of in the way communism worked. And so all of these things, and then add this. Yes, it is. But with God's help, healing can come. And I think that is something that we, as the Ukrainian Catholic Church, are very much aware of, is on the one hand, the incredible wounds that we carry, but also the incredible healing that comes from Christ. And that we, as the Ukrainian Catholic Church, and all the other churches within Ukraine, are called to be instruments of healing for this country.
Joy and hope, I think, are central to our Ukrainian spirituality. Mm. And that is despite the fact that, as Yale historian Timothy Snyder calls Ukraine and the area around Ukraine, the bloodlands, for a good part of the 20th century, between 1914 and 1945, the single deadliest place to be on Earth was in Ukraine. Mm. And there's a memory of this, and it's happening again. Mm-hmm. And yet that doesn't stop baptisms, weddings. It doesn't stop, as Brother Danilo said, at the front lines, people exclaiming Christ is risen, really kind of rejoicing in the risen Christ. I mean, that is, I think, not only important to our spirituality, but it's so important to our resistance, to manifest joy in the risen Christ. And that is so, so, so important to our spirituality that we can't live without it, I think it's safe to say.
It seems like the Byzantine Church has a stronger emphasis on the resurrection. The Latin Rite, I'm a preacher. We're always talking about the cross. I'm a Franciscan, you know. It's like, but I think the Byzantine in their liturgy, it's just written in there more, isn't it?
I think, you know, I've heard it said, and I've been told it may be a bit of an oversimplification, but that Latin spirituality can be kind of summarized in the cross and in the passion, whereas Byzantine spirituality can be summarized in the descent into Hades and the resurrection on the third day. But I think the fact is that none can happen without the other, and both of us approach these different themes in different ways and in different times. But there is certainly a focus on resurrection in our church generally, especially during our morning service matins, where we always read every morning the kind of resurrectional gospels. But at the same time, come to one of our churches during Lent, mm-hmm. and I don't think anybody will walk away from our churches during Lent thinking that we don't emphasize the cross or the passion,
because
we do take it very seriously. And we do co-suffer and tend to co-suffer with Christ. You come to one of our most kind of deepest services during Lent, the penitential canon of St. Andrew of Crete, and you don't have to go to the gym for months because you're doing something in the area of 200 to 300 prostrations, getting up and down and up and down before the cross. So we're a little different, but we all arrive at the same place, and that's the beauty of Catholic communion and all the different rites and traditions within the Catholic Church.
Yeah. I happen to be at a, I can celebrate it at a Byzantine rite during that, something about the cross, the triumph of the cross or the exaltation of the cross, I think. And they had a cross on a, they had a platter of, is it basil? Is that right?
In a Greek, in the Greek tradition, they'll put basil leaves around the cross and kind of make it fragrant.
Right. Yeah, we prostrated a lot and a lot of singing. I mean, it was like, it was an energetic liturgy, I gotta say. I wonder if that itself, you think, because you see in the Gospels, like the resurrection, people are running the tomb, running back, whatever. And it's like, it's something about emphasis on the resurrection that gets you energized and moving and stuff.
And that sounds like it was during Lent. And so even Sundays during Lent, you know, for example, in our tradition, we don't refrain from singing Alleluia during Lent.
In fact, we add more Alleluia.
We add more Alleluia
for what the Latins are missing.
But again, we arrive at the same place. I mean, it's you know, I think joy is has to be a central common theme. But we, given our experience, tend to focus on it maybe a bit more than others.
Mm. Well, let me ask you as we near the end here. This is May 2025, and I know it's, of course, it's been all, the war has been in American news a lot. And what do you all think? I know seminarians, priests, and everything are always reflecting, and I don't know what it is about seminaries and stuff, but what do you all think is going to happen, basically? Where is this going to end up?
Well, if I could tell the future, I'm not sure if I'd be here at EWTN with you.
I
don't think this would be the right place for me. So I can't predict the future. Mm. However, like Natalia mentioned, there's not a single Ukrainian who wants to see this war go on another day. Mm. And that is why, it perhaps counterintuitively, but it makes sense to Ukrainians, Ukrainians continue to fight so that this war will be the war to end all wars that Ukraine has suffered over the last 400 years. Mm. So where will it end? I think, you know, as with any war and every war, it does end in some sort of agreement. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen, not to get too geopolitical, is that the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian government, has come together as a broad coalition to come up with a negotiation to stop the bloodshed. Mm-hmm. And they have traveled to Istanbul, and they have agreed to ceasefire after ceasefire. They've agreed to so many different strategies and plans to end the war, and President Putin simply will not engage, mm-hmm. simply will not agree to end the war. And so I think, you know, he is showing his true colors. He has alluded in the past to being interested in ending the war. But now with Europe, Turkey, the US, Ukraine, all of them really giving up a lot and saying, we will negotiate with you. We are ready for peace. The Russians are demonstrating that they're not interested in peace. Mm-hmm. And so how do Ukrainians get peace in a lasting way? Is by there being some sort of, and far be it for me to make the decisions that are made in Kyiv or in Ankara or in Brussels or in Moscow, but in some way there has to be a mechanism to prevent Russia from ever invading again, and killing children, abducting children, persecuting Christians, occupying territory, because that's bad for all of us. Mm-hmm. And it gives implicit permission to other countries like Iran and China to do the very same thing. If we don't stop authoritarianism, especially anti-Christian authoritarianism, in our day in Ukraine, we have no way of stopping it from happening in another place. That sets a very, very bad precedent and a violent precedent for the future. And so the Ukrainians are willing to keep fighting, but they need to make sure that once they put down their arms, that they won't need to pick them up again. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that is the world that we live in. Ukraine in 1994 gave up the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world. Talk about a commitment to peace. Mm-hmm. Ukrainians have been committed to peace longer than anybody. But in exchange for giving up the largest nuclear third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, the United States, the UK, and Russia, who received Ukraine's nuclear weapons, agreed to never change the borders of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And when a country like North Korea or Iran wants to develop their nuclear programs, and we genuinely want that, to live in a denuclearized mm-hmm. world, in a safer world where not every little dictator can come up with nuclear weapons, they say, well, why should we? You know, why should North Korea give up its nuclear weapons if they fear being invaded from the South? So we need to demonstrate that we're committed to peace, that we're committed to denuclearization, that we're committed to these principles by demonstrating that Ukraine giving up its nuclear weapons was not a mistake. The Ukraine defending itself and keeping to the international treaties that every other country, including the United States, has bound to with a kind of an oath of honesty, that matters. Because if it's demonstrated to not matter, then all the people who hate peace and all the people who hate what we represent, especially as Christians, will not only seek to destroy that, but very well may succeed. And we just cannot let that happen.
The future is in God's hands, and Ukrainians live every day with deep reliance on God. And never forget that truth is the truth. Truth will prevail. Mm. That's our strong belief.
Yeah. Let me ask you one more question. Well, Liz, did you have something you wanted to say, brother? What are the similarities and the distinction between the Ukraine and Russia that in your cultures and things? You're both Eastern, but I mean, how do y'all see that? Is there any similarity in your mind?
I'll have you answer first.
There is a lot more difference than people think. Mm-hmm. It's a difference of mentality. It's a difference religiously. Ukraine is what one might call a land that's in between. It's in between civilizations, and so which makes for that fertile ground for, you know, very large diversity. And why the Ukrainian Catholic Church exists, right? It's because it's on that border of civilizations. And that definitely very strongly influenced the creation and the development of the country. It's the language. The language has been different for centuries. In fact, you know, when people say, well, you know, you all speak Russian in essence, it's very far from the truth. It is something that Russia has been trying to propagate since the 17th century. Yeah. And there have been numerous laws in the Russian Empire, but during communism and even now, to try and eradicate the Ukrainian language or to make it a dialect of sorts. But there are writings within the Church of Saint Sophia that go as far back as the 12th, 13th century that already have, you know, a proto-Ukrainian, which is very different from the Church Slavonic that was used at that time. It's obviously it has a similar root, but they were using the grammar structures of Ukrainian So in Kyiv, in the 12th, 13th century, the language that was spoken was Proto-Ukrainian, unlike in Russia, where they spoke what is the Proto-Russian. There's cultural differences, there's mindset differences, there's mentality differences in the question of, you know, freedom loving. Ukrainians have been fighting for freedom and this understanding of independence for centuries. That's just, it's part of the makeup. I don't know if you know of Blessed Karl Habsburg, the last emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His son, Otto von Habsburg, was only died in 2011. And in the institute I was at, he gave talks every once in a while, especially when my parents were students. And there are other talks that he gave, and he would speak, and he would say, you know, he knew all the people that had lived within the Austro-Hungarian Empire quite well. And he said, Ukrainians were incredible fighters for their freedom. They're not great at building political structures, but they're incredibly great at fighting for their freedom. Because there's this, and that's why, you know, you had revolution after 1991, because people were like, no, this is not the way we want to be going. We don't want to return into some kind of dictatorship, some kind of vassal of Russia. And they kept fighting for it. And that's certainly something that's in the blood of Ukrainians. Russians are a lot more, one might say, patient with whatever is happening above them.
Right.
It's also very important to note that Ukraine has never engaged in imperial conquest. They never want for more than what they have. Our Archbishop Boris Gudziak talks about the sin of Adam being the sin of the grab, of taking, and that is something that is longstanding Russian imperial, especially tradition. You don't get to be a country that spans, I think it's 15 time zones, without wanting more. Ukraine is blessed to have very fertile land, enough to feed its people, the breadbasket of Europe, and they've never wanted for more. Mm-hmm. They've never invaded another country. They've always been invaded. And that can create cultural differences that I think are very acutely felt. It's also important to note that Ukraine, the Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, is just as far from Moscow as it is from Warsaw. Mm-hmm. And almost as far over the Black Sea from Constantinople. To underline Brother Danilo's point, Ukraine means borderland. And right. the difference between Ukrainian and Polish and Ukrainian and Russian is like, you know, Italian and Portuguese and French. They're just different languages and different people.
Right.
Like full stop.
Right.
And the Russians pretending that there's some sort of similarity there because they can't exist without Ukraine, but Ukraine can exist without Russia, is a Russian problem, not a Ukrainian problem. What is a problem of ours now because they invaded us?
I can say that Ukrainians cherish individualism while Russians tend to collectivism. We love freedom and democracy. They tend to totalitarian regimes. They want always to say that our king, our tsar is guilty of our failures. We don't decide anything. No, we Ukrainians say we decide. How we want to live, and we can agree or disagree with one another, but we are one family.
Right.
That's, I think, the main differences between us. And also what?
First democratic constitution predates the American constitution by about 90 years, was the Cossack constitution of Pilip Orlik. Where they determined how do you vote for a leader, how do you organize a society in a democratic way, who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote. Particularly women got the right to vote 300 years ago, before the United States was even independent.
300 years ago.
And it was a very kind of important democratic process, and this was happening as the Russians were increasingly taking over Ukraine, and so they needed to codify their tradition of democracy in a constitution as they were becoming refugees in Europe. And so that kind of democratic tradition, one that nonetheless is very faith-based, is also very dignity-based. And so to Natalia's point, the concept of kind of inherent human dignity, the dignity of the person, but also as a member of the community and kind of trusting in the democratic kind of process and the responsibility to another is still there as well. Mm-hmm. Especially because, again, Ukrainians are traditionally a very agrarian people, so you don't have to depend on others, but you have to also understand in the inherent dignity of the individual.
Right. Let me ask you too about Fatima. We just had the celebration of Our Lady of Fatima, May 13th. Do you all speak of that? Is there a connection seen? Because the part of the secrets were about Russia continuing to spread her errors, as a punishment due to sin that, and all that stuff. Do y'all see any? Do y'all talk about the Fatima connection or anything? Or
I think I definitely grew up hearing a lot about it,
and
it's something that we definitely speak of. Do you have about Fatima? Is there much knowledge of that?
More or less.
I think here in the U.S., Ukrainian Greek Catholics have a particular devotion to Our Lady of Fatima and frequently go on pilgrimages there. There's a Greek Catholic church in Fatima. Many Greek Catholics, Ukrainian Greek Catholics in the United States were refugees from World War II, political refugees. Many were dissidents. And so I think the concept of kind of Christian, of saving Russia from itself, for me to kind of broadly paraphrase, I think really resonated, because there isn't as much of a clear line between the kind of politics of the church and the spirituality of the church. They kind of just felt that, well, our experience is one of survival, and if the people who are constantly oppressing us need to be converted, then that's what we'll pray for. So I think in the diaspora, because the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church was illegal in Ukraine for much of the 20th century, so outside of Ukraine, Our Lady of Fatima most certainly has a very, very strong devotion and is very often a pilgrimage site, because we know that peace won't come to Ukraine without Russia having a deep change of heart.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking with us, and just want to encourage everybody listening to this, of course, to pray for peace, to pray for the people of Ukraine, and especially to pray to Our Lady and her role in interceding for us in that peace. So, thank you so much.
Thank you.